Arrow, Trico, I'm fucking famished. I want to make my favorite breakfast, but I can't find the recipe anywhere. Can you please look for it? Matt looked haggard. His belly tum grumbled like a roiling bog of viscous, bubbling brack, and there wasn't anything he could make without a recipe book in the entire Aerocast studio castle. Well, he could eat Chris's frozen cereal, but that marshmallow shit didn't suit his non-decadent breakfast palace. Plus, apparently it was a prize-sealed collector's item, so go figure. Arrow, murmured Trico. Matt looks hungry as fuck. Well, at least he isn't thirsty as fuck for once. And watch your language, quipped Arrow. Where the H-E double hockey sticks could that bumbling lummox had left his breakfast recipe? Arrow wondered if it could be for Fiddlesticks, because this was gosh darn ridiculous. She looked under the fridge, on top of the fridge, behind the fridge, in the fridge, in the freezer of the fridge, in the crisper of the fridge, and under the magnets affixed to the sides in front of the fridge. No luck, huh? Then she remembered the magnets on the back of the fridge, but they too came up empty. Trico looked in the pantry, in the recipe bookshelf, in the study, in the pile of old scribblers, in the side table drawer, everywhere. Can't you just go on all recipes or some shit? Asked Arrow. Nah, I like my breakfast a certain way only, replied Matt. When did you last see it? Yesterday at breakfast. And you can't remember the contents? Sort of, but I want it to be exact. Arrow and Trico spent the next several hours scouring the castle for any clue whatsoever, but all of the usual and sensible places to put a recipe just couldn't bear fruit. It's always in the last place you look, added Matt, helpfully. Helpfully. Arrow relented. She waved her magic wand and shrunk Trico down to the size of a house cat. Trico perched on her shoulder, and Arrow began directing Trico to bop every tile, patch of drywall, brick, and panel in sequence, until finally, the 30th ceiling tile in the upstairs master bathroom that Matt called the master bathroom turned into a sheet of paper and floated to the ground in front of Arrow. She picked it up, and her brow furrowed. Matt, this just says bacon, next to eggs, and two away from toast. Yes, that's it. Thank you so much, Arrow and Trico, but it's late evening now. I think I'll just order a burger. So,
what an intro!
A little bit inspired, but we'll talk about why later. This is the podcast, the Aerocast for August 2019, covering Eight Eyes, the seminal NES classic. But before we get into Eight Eyes, Chris, how is your August?
August has been pretty good. We're recording pretty late in September. Okay, it's not pretty late in September, but recording in September much later than expected because I recently went on vacation and then, you know, my flight got delayed and then I got incredibly sick. So, I mean, it started off pretty good and then it just ended up poorly, but I'm well enough for the podcast now, so I guess that's all that matters.
Yeah, the only important thing in life is the Aerocast.
Yes, yes. But in terms of games, I haven't been playing too much because I've just been so busy. Earlier in the month, I had been playing a bit of Pokemon Crystal just to wrap up that Pokedex from our last AgroCast, and then I just got bored of JRPGs again. So that phase just came and went, like I said. And then I was just trying to play a bit of Sekiro here and there, and then a bit of Monster Hunter to get ready for Iceborne, but then I got sick when Iceborne came out, and I haven't touched it since, so it's still waiting for me. But otherwise, the only game I really got to clear while I was on vacation was the story mode of Cadence of Hyrule. I got to play that, and it's okay, I guess. I guess it's because of the story mode. I don't know if there is a seed, and then you kind of just save on it, so you just keep exploring the overworld and collecting things. But it just seemed more than it needed to be, I think. I guess because it was a Zelda game, I felt like I should be getting items, and then in the end you don't really need most of them, if anything. Like, the bow, I don't think you ever really need at all. Maybe it would be useful for some enemies if you want to take them down in a different way, but otherwise, I had a spear, and then I found out how you can enhance it to obsidian, so that just kind of broke the game pretty early on. I mean, bomb shoes are good just because you can explode things from a range. Hookshot, I think you definitely need to get. I don't know. I guess items are randomized. I don't know where they are hidden throughout the overworld when you launch a game. But yeah, I guess it was okay and maybe a little too easy because I did go after hearts because I thought that was what you're supposed to do. It's a Zelda game, right? So I did that. But I guess, you know, having Obsidian Spear and just knowing how to play Necrodancer, it just kind of went by pretty easily. I think it might be more interesting if I give it another try when I ever get my own Switch and play it with, you know, randomized seeds like a normal roguelike game, but no, it was okay, I guess. I just think I need to give it another chance with the parameters that I'm more comfortable with.
The dungeons are at least randomized, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, they're kind of like little NecroDancer, like, zones, but that's about it. The overworld from story mode that I played on wasn't randomized, but I don't know if it's randomized at launch or it's because, I just wanted to play story mode like how the game wanted me to, so I left it to do that instead of just having it have a more roguelike aspect to it.
Yeah, the story mode is probably a little bit more accessible because it's got the Zelda license. But I'm sure it has some more true roguelike modes, and I find with a lot of these games, even ones that have sort of set dungeons, they'll always have a like a super dungeon or whatever. So maybe the game has something like that, a couple of dungeons in sequence to emulate that.
Yeah, I didn't look too deeply into anything like super challenging. I know there's a character you can unlock if you give a certain character like 20 Deku Nuts, and then you get someone sort of like Aria, but I don't think they have the restrictment that you can't miss any beats. It's just the low damage and low health kind of thing. But I didn't unlock that.
The only spoiler I wanted to know is if Tingle's in it.
Yeah, Tingle's in it.
As the character to play as?
No.
Well, that's horseshit. Okay, I'm not going to bother getting that game
Well, I guess
on
that's it
Switch.
then, what's the point?
No, I'll probably get that if I ever get a Switch myself. It sounds about what I expected, to be honest. But it still sounds good.
I can't say it was bad. I just thought maybe I just need to give another chance with like a play style that I'm more comfortable with.
Right.
Like maybe I put it on quote unquote easy mode for me. And I only did that because I thought that's what the game wanted, but I mean, there's still an option to play with randomized seeds like any roguelike, so maybe that's what something I should do, especially now that I completed the game and I kind of understand like how it wants me to play it. Anyway, that was about all of it for me. Matt, how has your August been? How's Iceborne?
August has been busy. I was also a little bit sick earlier. I had a pretty bad ear infection, so I didn't really get enough done that I wanted to get done this month. My province got hit by Hurricane Dorian. I really have no complaints because, unlike places like the Bahamas, we really got off quite scot-free from it. But anyways, I've had a couple of things to deal with through August, but I still got to get through a couple of things. So, in terms of what I've been playing, SNES games mostly for the backlog stuff I wanted to get through. I played through played through Spanky's Quest, and that doesn't mean I just fapped. It's an interesting game that you play as a monkey that can, like, it's fucking bizarre. You have to like launch a bubble up, and then you can like dribble the bubble with your head, and then depending on the size of the bubble, when you let it break, it'll turn into like soccer balls or basketballs or whatever and do a certain amount of damage to enemies. It's actually quite a fun game, but it's a little bit difficult to describe exactly what you're doing. You fight like different fruits like pineapples and stuff, so it's cool. I mean, whatever, it's a cool game. And I also played through Macross Scrambled Valkyrie, the Super Famicom game, just on Hikaru's line so far. I have to do Max and Milia, but it's a very difficult game at times, especially towards the end. It gets quite difficult. It's a shmup set, of course, in the Macross universe, and every character has, different weapons for their Fighter, Gearwalk, and Batroid modes of their Valkyrie, the transformable fighters in Macross. So there's a lot of options in terms of who you're playing as, even though there's three characters which have three transformations each, and the game's quite good and has a lot of cool effects. It's not quite Third Lightning level, but it's really good. And it's a game that I picked up a while back now, but Honestly, I use a Game Genie as a pass-through for a Super Famicom games. So I filed down a Super Game Genie with the tabs on so I could fit them, because I didn't want to file down the tabs in the Super Nintendo. So playing Super Famicom games is a little bit for me. I'm kind of starting to think I want to get a Super Famicom or Super Famiclone just as a dedicated console there. We'll see what happens. I don't have a big collection of them. I have just a handful of Super Famicom games, but it would definitely make me want to play them more if I didn't have to just struggle with having an intermediate into getting them working. So, I don't know. We'll see what happens there. Good game, though. I've been a fan of it for a long, long time.
Do they even still make more Macross games? Actually, it's probably a gacha game, I think. So,
I have Macross 30 that came out on the PS3, and that was like the 30th anniversary game. I have to learn how to play through it at some point. I've only really broken the surface of it, but it's all right. I'm not a huge fan of the Robotech game on GameCube, Battle Cry. It's not that good. Now, I'm not saying it's necessarily because that's Robotech instead of Macross, because the Game Boy Advance Robotech game was kind of good, but the Battle Cry I didn't really like that much. Anyhow, I guess we mentioned Spaceborne is out, and I've been playing it. I've been playing through it slowly. I'm trying to get all of the optional quests done before I progress the story, so it's taking a little bit of time. I'm not really going to mention any more about the game. I'm enjoying it. I'll probably talk a lot more about it in a month's time, because the only new monsters I fought are monsters I fought in the beta. So there's not a whole lot to talk about yet. Well, I fought Baryoth, but anyways, I'll talk about that in a month.
Yeah, and hopefully by then I will have played some finally, after I've been looking forward to it.
So, Eight Eyes is a game with a little circle. It was developed by Thinking Rabbit and published by Taxan, released in Japan in 1988 and North America in 1990. Published by Sega in Japan, sorry. The game's often been accused of being a poor version of Castlevania, and the inspiration is definitely there. Like, the game looks like Castlevania, but it has a lot of unique features unto itself. The story of the game, a little bit strange, but also par for the course. It's sort of Crystalis, except Castlevania. This is hundreds of years after a nuclear war. There's a great king who harnessed the power of eight eyes, these gemstones, but then it's like, shit, this king's eight dukes, they're like, fuck you. We're going to take these gems and we're going to control the earth. So, the Great King is banished, and you take on the role of Orin the Falconer, who is like the king's main bro, his top guardsman. And then you venture it with Cutrus, or Cutrus, I'm not sure the pronunciation of the falcon's name, but it's your falcon that fights alongside you. That's sort of the gist of Eight Eyes. It's, I won't start talking about it because that's the point of the podcast. We'll talk about it as presents itself as a bog standard game, but how progression is affected, how you find clues, and so on and so forth, it's a bit different. So we're going to get right into it. With the usual question, do you yourself have any experience with Eight Eyes?
I don't have any experience with Eight Eyes, and I think the only way I have heard about this game in the past is that it was a bad Castlevania clone, and I probably looked at it then, and that was about it. I was like, it doesn't quite seem like Castlevania enough for me, and that was when I was didn't even actually want to look further into it, but, you know, that's what this podcast is for, so it's an eye-opening experience.
Oh, eye-opening experience.
Yeah, you see what I did there? Very good, yeah.
Yeah. All right, now. So, in terms of myself, my experience with 8Eyes is, just getting into collecting games and finding the game, cool cover, cool name, picking it up, trying to play it, and not really doing very well at all. The game is, I don't know if I want to say it's a difficult game, because once you know what to do, it's not so bad. But for instance, like enemy order, like the boss order, that's not required but heavily suggested to do. I had no idea about that. I had no idea about finding clues or things like that, just in terms of playing through the game. So I never got really far in it. I thought I just didn't catch on to whatever finesse was needed to use Cutrus in tandem with Orin. So I kind of put it away and kind of kept looking at it, kind of wanted to get back to it, but I don't know. I just never surmounted the learning curve back when I first tried it, and then there's always been other games I pick up because I actively buy games, and it just kind of fell by the wayside. So I mentioned that there is some unique mechanics to 8Eyes. How does the game play, and what elements are unique to this game?
I want to be comparing it to Castlevania, even though we really should not be. But one of the first things you can do in this game is actually have a stage select. And you kind of mentioned that there is kind of a suggested order. The manual does say that you should start with a country near France, so we'll get into that when we talk to the game properly. So 8Eyes can also be a two-player game, potentially, but if you're playing as a single player, Orin can release Kuturis to fly in a sort of wave pattern and then dive for things. If you're playing as two players, then you can control Kuturis flying around, which is probably a lot easier because you can be stuck in some rooms where stuff is still flying at you, and you really want to send Kuturis out to attack enemies or hit every freaking tile in that screen. But it's a cool feature to have.
I don't know if I have it written in the notes here, but like some of the similarities in terms of Castlevania is also with like sub-weapons. Did you find any of the sub-weapons useful in 8Eyes?
Well, I guess there's one that's really good,
Yeah, there's
and
one
that's
that's
about it.
super good.
And I guess I played around with some of them. You do get one sub-weapon, but I didn't find it really good against enemies. It was good at picking up stuff that were stuck in walls, but that's about it.
The boomerang
Yeah.
that can hit switches too that may want to use instead of the Cutrus, but generally I saved all of my weapon ammo for
The
the
boss,
boss
yeah.
using the ice ball, but
Also, can I mention for an NES game released in North America in 1990, they still use crosses? Like, those weren't censored out?
I don't think the censors would have got that far in the game, to be honest. No, yeah, it's a little bit surprising. A little bit surprising. I guess the one other element I don't really talk about through the rest of the cast, but it should be mentioned, is that you have a base amount of health and item ammunition for playing through, and you get reset every time you start the level. And you kind of find these jars throughout the level that'll either increase your stats or give you a special power or whatever. How did you feel about that? Because that's a bit strange. Going instead of getting like a permanent upgrade at the end of the level, you kind of upgrade yourself throughout.
Yeah, it's kind of confusing, because it feels like you made no progress. You start off a new stage and you're wondering, where did all the health I just spent 500 hours looking for this tile for went? But I think most stages have a jar that you can find at the entrance that will replenish all your health. I think there's like two. I couldn't find it because I probably didn't search through any. I didn't search thoroughly enough, but maybe that's just how it is.
No, there's a couple I couldn't find the jar at the start, but yeah, there's. Anyhow, that's sort of the mechanics of the game. It's simple on its face, but once you try to control the your Falcon in tandem with your Falconer, sometimes it gets a little bit hairy, but we're going to talk a little bit about that as we go through the game. as we mentioned at the start, Eight Eyes allows you to select seven different stages. Each is based on a country. Well, one is Africa, is based on a continent, even though there's an African country in here.
I was going to make that joke at one point. Like, I'm glad to go to cool countries like Italy and Egypt and the entire continent of Africa.
Yeah, exactly. As we kind of mentioned, there's a suggested order to these levels, because one of the biggest misnomers in this game is that when you beat a level, it says that you have a more powerful sword, and that's not true at all. It only means that that particular sword is stronger against one particular boss than the sword you previously had, and the sword that you start with is strong against a certain boss as well. And the only clue that you have in terms of where to start, I think you mentioned it in the intro to the game, is that the game is like, hey, you better start with this country that's close to France. And I don't know if they mean geographically or on the select screen, but you kind of parse out that Spain is close to France, I suppose. And yeah, Spain is the first level that we go to. But before we get into that, we're just going to kind of progress through these levels. The levels aren't very intricate. We'll talk mainly about sort of the... mostly about the bosses, I guess, even though they're pretty straightforward as well. But also about elements that get introduced into these levels as we go. And honestly, the way that the game wants you to progress through it, I'd say that it's a pretty natural progression in terms of level difficulty. But I think the most difficult boss is fought a little early in the game, but I won't spoil who that is. We'll get to Spain. So Spain, it's mostly human enemies, and they kind of progress towards you and attack. In general, how does the fencing feel in this game?
There's a lot of the fencing element in this game. When you encounter enemies who sort of also have a sword or a spear, something that you could sort of quote-unquote counter against, the best way to take care of them is to bait them into your range, and then once they do their swing animation, then you come in and stab them, which is roughly like 3 hits for these human enemies here, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it depends on who you're fighting, and sometimes you fight armored enemies, and sometimes there's giant bats that aren't worth fighting. But, yeah, in general, I find it's like you hitting them back off after a bit. It doesn't feel entirely natural to me, but it works in a way. Obviously, there's not enough buttons on the NES controller to, you know, feasibly have a backstep in the game, but I think that would be a lot better if you could backstep. Sometimes for these enemies, especially for like the spear guys or any enemy that takes a beating, I will send Cutrus out first. How does Cutrus feel, especially when you're controlling him as a one-player game?
Yeah, starting off in this first level and learning how to play the game, Cutrus was a little difficult to understand how to use properly. Depending on where you send out Cutrus, Cutrus will fly out in the sort of wave pattern on the screen, and you can also command Cutrus to do a dive in something, which is what you're going to be using to find every tile in this game. You can also use Cutrus to attack enemies, and only certain enemies can be defeated by Cutrus, as the manual points out. That's why it's important to read the manual. But otherwise, especially because it was a single-player game, it's kind of difficult to have Cutrus attacking things while you're also trying to block or run away or, you know, evade an enemy yourself. Cutrus has their own health bar, and, you know, I never had either one of them. I didn't have Cutrus die, but I didn't like that idea. So, you know, I want to protect my bird friend. I don't know. I didn't want to send Cutrus out too much, but mostly what I had Cutrus do was if I couldn't defeat an enemy, then that's what I would have Cutrus attack, because that's what the game wants you to do, and also just the tile. Exploring,
yes,
fun,
yes,
times.
That situation. Yeah, definitely that situation. Yeah, I found Cutrus as well a little bit weird at first, and I think that is probably why I felt I lacked the finesse the game wanted me to have back when I played this. But really, there's only so much finesse you have with this Falcon. So, I think it works all right once you understand that, again, once you set it, it's kind of set at that same level all the time until you call it back. But yeah, I find I find the Falcon quite useful, and I made a lot of use of Kutris. I do want to talk a little bit about the level structure for one particular reason. This is a very vertical level. It's sort of a tower. You climb one side and then descend the other side. Did you find that in this game, dropping down a floor or climbing up a floor, sometimes you get hit in a way that's really difficult or not able to avoid?
I just feel like this game in general was me getting hit by things that maybe I should have been hit by, but I guess the game decided that, yeah, okay. And they're kind of like Castlevania stairs, except it's not immediate death if you don't hit up on them. But yeah, it's still annoying, especially when you get, like, bats or skulls, and they also fly in a wave pattern, and I'm just trying to move, and yeah.
Yes, the skulls at least drop some health and ammo refill stuff, so I usually grind it or farmed on them until they disappeared. But yeah, I kind of found there were sometimes I entered a screen and it just got hit. But the game's sometimes a little bit of a sort of a war of attrition, and that's why it's helpful to know where these items are, because you know you can kind of damage boost through a lot of this game. I watched a couple of speedruns after playing it, and it's sort of damage boosting through as much as possible and then refilling. So, I mean, that's a possible way to play the game. Maybe not the most fun for a casual playthrough, but yeah, it pays to search with Kutris, because there's a lot of damage that you may not be able to avoid taking. So we get to the first boss, Enrique Bartona, and we fight this fencer for the Black Pearl. That's it's the Black Pearl named the Black Butterfly of Parashusu. How does the first boss go?
Well, I also want to point out to my favorite manual here. It says that there's a special weapon that works best against each boss. And you're like, okay, which weapon is it? And you cycle through them, and you find out the
yes.
only most interesting one is the ice ball, which freezes them in place and lets you just stab them like 5 times, and then you just repeat the process. And this is why you should always have a full item bar just to spam the heck out of ice ball.
I wonder if by special weapon they mean word you get from the previous boss. Because, I don't know, if it came down to like using the gun or using a lot of damage to a boss, that could be cool. But I never found the actual sub-weapons great to use on the bosses.
Yeah, except for ice ball.
The ice ball is for a broken bus. Yeah.
I don't know if it was intentional, but yeah, the ice ball just seems to work so well. So, I mean, the first thing you do is kind of, you see this boss, you're like, okay, cycle through my items, see what works best. Ice ball, freeze in place, good. This is all I'm going to do now.
Yeah, I think if you go toe-to-toe with Enrique, you're probably in for a loss if you're not using the ice ball.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's actually kind of difficult to do the proper fencing with this guy. But what happens when we beat a boss in 8 eyes?
Once we collect our cool Black Pearl, we get to sit down with dinner with them, and a skeleton will serve us tea.
Yeah.
So I guess we didn't actually, like, kill them, but, you know, maybe that we talk about our feelings or something, and then some skeleton just comes by and gives us tea.
It's like, why are you hating on the Great King? You're supposed to be one of his dukes.
No. And who's the skeleton? What's the lore? Now, I kind of said this off podcast, but I thought it would be a neat touch if whoever serves you tea is an enemy that appeared in that level. Because, I mean, there's no skeletons in this level, but there'll be some later on.
Oh, there'll be loads of skeletons.
Oh, yes. Yes, too many.
That being said, let's move on to a skeleton stage. A stage with skeleton bones, Egypt.
I want to say on my first playthrough, I did not know Egypt was the second stage. So
no.
I was like, okay, so what's next? I guess I'll just go to Africa next, because that was the stage that was next on the map, going clockwise, and that was not fun. That was a mistake. We'll talk about Africa more in a bit.
But did you, but just to jump ahead, did you clear Africa at that point?
No, I did not because it didn't go well for me, and I was like, what am I doing wrong here?
Okay.
So I went to my loyal website, Game FAQs, and wondered what was up with that. I'm like, oh, these
Yeah.
stages are numbered. That's interesting.
And Africa is a bit of a maze as well, so we'll get to it. We'll get to
We'll
it.
get to it, but
But hey,
yes.
we're in Africa. We're in Egypt.
That's technically true, you're right.
Yeah, so Egypt introduces some moving platforms and time switches. How is the platforming in this game?
Fortunately, in Egypt, there's not many moving platforms, so it's not that big of a deal, but platforming can be a little obnoxious, especially if there's like some enemy throwing mud at you and you're just trying to jump over there. It's not
Yeah.
happening, but otherwise, it's not too bad. And for time switches, I think it's just a neat aspect. You kind of just figure out a good position to send out Kutris, and then Kutris will die while you're probably near the door or something.
I've tried making the run to the door from the switches myself before, and yeah, it's like generally there's just enough time that you can get just about to the door and it'll.
Close on you again.
I thought that was a pretty cool touch. Now, where Spain was mostly humanoid enemies, Egypt has a lot of monsters, like these green monsters, these ghosts that don't appear in any other room game. There's the skeletons, and then you mentioned you like the mud men.
Oh, yes. Especially when you're just really trying to jump somewhere. Come on.
Yeah, so the mud men, they kind of just fling mud through. It's almost like the mummy boss in Castlevania, really.
Where are all the mummy enemies in this, huh?
Yeah, I guess it'd be too on the nose.
I may be.
But the green devil monsters, I think only Kutris can kill them.
Yeah, I think so.
Which sort of makes you wonder what's the indication that Kutris can kill something, if it's a green devil or if it's a guy with a bullwhip. I don't know. But Egypt is still a pretty straightforward level. Just that there's a lot of different kind of monsters. The boss, however, Neri Thanatos, a sorcerer who likes to jump a whole lot, you fight this dude for the Red Ruby, the Blood of Tutankhamun.
So this is another thing I want to mention in my beloved manual of this game. Why does everyone in this game look normal except for this guy? Have you seen his artwork? It's just weird.
Maybe he's a mummy.
Or an alien. Maybe that's the weird connection there. But any case, just like the last boss, you can just throw ice ball and then fence the heck out of him and then repeat the process.
Yeah, and one thing to mention about the ice ball, because Neri Thanatos likes to jump a lot, you might miss. But the ice ball will hit a wall and come rolling back like the whole length of the room. So it's actually a really, really good sub-weapon. So, yeah. Well, this guy has a projectile. It's not really that bad. And if he's got the right sword, yeah, he goes out like a sucker. So, not too bad at all.
Yeah.
Now, from Egypt, we go to Italy. And we're back to a lot of human enemies. The whip guys we mentioned are only vulnerable to Kutris. Mostly a standard level, but there are sort of the panthers that are kind of like the Black Panthers from Castlevania. You know, surprise, su
Oh,
surprise.
yes.
How do you feel about the panthers? Because they're probably the most dangerous enemy in this stage, I think.
Panthers are pretty cool, but a really good pattern for them is you kind of stab them and then duck, and then stab them and then duck again.
So it's sort of easier to defense a panther than a human, I guess.
I guess so.
Now, I want to mention that the boss for this level is probably the boss I had the most trouble with. Gino Comechio, a card thrower, and he fights you with his panther. And you fight this guy for the Green Emerald, the Dancing Princess of Frenelia. What do you think of this boss?
I think it was a cool combination that he brought his panther with him. So while he's like out throwing 1,000 cards at you, I found it best to just try to fight off his panther first and soak up the damage for then. But if you actually search those walls, there's this G jar kind of thing, And that makes you invincible for a few seconds. So I think they put in that room just so you can, after you defeat the Panther, just use the G jar and then continue your usual ice ball and fencing strategy.
Yeah, because I think for this particular boss, that G jar is there just so you can approach it, because it's really hard to approach Geno, because as you said, there's lots of cards flying your way. And you can either throw an ice ball from a distance, he'll be thawed out by the time you get to him, or you can get this jar and get up close to him. But if he appears on screen and starts attacking you before you kill the Panther, it gets a little bit hairy. And if you try to approach him without invulnerability, it gets a little bit hairy as well. So I think that in terms of all of the enemies in this, maybe the Germany boss is also kind of tough in how it attacks, at least for me. I found this probably the hardest of the bosses. And the bosses aren't super hard in a vacuum, but I found Geno the most difficult after playing through a stage, for sure.
And I should note, you can like fence away projectiles, but in most cases,
Yes.
especially this one, it's just a pain. You can't get the timing right, and there's gonna be a lot coming at you anyway.
So we have a little bit of a enemy upgrade, I feel, when we get to India. Because the Indian knife throwers and fencers, they seem a lot more aggressive than previous.
I felt like they were a bit stronger, but that's also
Yeah.
maybe my perception.
I think that's just me trying to give a confirmation bias to the of the game, but it just feels like they're stronger enemies, and maybe that's true, maybe it's not.
I mean, they kind of move in the same, bait and attack pattern that you would do for the enemies back in Spain, but they just feel strong when they hit you.
So India is mostly a straightforward level again. I think the only trouble spots are sort of some jumps that are after you jump, there's one of these trident enemies at the other side. And maybe that's like they could push you back or do a lot of damage to you.
Yeah, that
And I
guy was a
find,
jerk. Just like that mudslinger.
So I usually try to take those out from a distance with Kutris or I don't know if I use sub weapons on them, because I save those as at this point you've come to respect the sheer power of the ice ball. But yeah, I think those are the only real trouble spots in this level. And this is the last stage, I guess I can do, because the next couple kind of shake things up a little bit in terms of level structure until we get to Arabia. But India, again, is a pretty standard level, just that the enemies seem to be. Now, the boss, Cipher Nasim, is a yoga master who can teleport, and we fight this dude for the yellow obsidian, the Wing of Angels. How did you find Cipher Nasim?
Well, Ice Ball missed a few times, but fortunately I saved enough that it was enough to just wreck him, as always.
He has a projectile after he teleports, I believe. I think the one problem I have with this boss is when you freeze him mid-teleport, I don't think he can do damage to him. There was some state of freezing him that I could not damage him, so I wasted a couple of.
Yeah, I don't recall, but I know I cut it close, so maybe that's what was happening.
But overall, not too bad. It's just that trying to control how he teleports and trying not to get him to teleport away too quickly after he's reappeared so he can land a couple of hits. At the very least, it's mixed things up in hand. Now we get to Africa, which is the level you said you went to early,
I
which.
unfortunately went too early. Actually, I'm just
Yeah, which is
unfortunate we're here
unfortunate.
anyway, so.
Although there's another maze level in. I find Africa, it requires a certain sequence of movements without like audio visual feedback, as far as I know. How did you find the maze of Africa?
It was. Considering there's no feedback, It was pretty awful, and so thank goodness that I remember that GameFAQs was there to tell me the stage order and also have a map telling me how to get through this level. So, like, yeah, I cheated on this, but you know what? I don't know how you would figure it out otherwise with trial and error, which just seems like more exhausting than it needs to be.
Yeah, especially since there's a lot of rooms that look the same. I'm gonna search all the tiles and all that.
Yeah, and the
I
color
think,
palette, I guess, just makes it irritating after a while. I don't know.
it would be interesting if there was, it'd be interesting if Eight Eyes was in some ways, a little bit more like Simon's Quest in terms of you travel to these castles, but there is a hub or what have you where you can, provide things to people to get sort of hints about how to get through these levels. Maybe make the levels a little bit more robust than they are because they're all quite short. But have someone give you a vague hint of how to get through Africa. When you go down, continue down three more times or whatever the hell you have to do in that screen after you first go down.
Oh, gosh.
But you have to go down like three times in that screen or something like that. And it's like, how. Like, what's the indication that this is going to happen?
God, was this like listen to Nintendo Power? Like, please tell me.
I mean, like in the Legend of Zelda, you have things that don't have audiovisual until you complete them. But there's hints in the game that tell you to get through.
Well, I always remember Nintendo Power, that map of the second quest.
How did you like the enemies here? There's sort of Zulu spear enemies that just stab and some that throw. And I think there's some like ibis birds in this level as well.
Anything that flies in that wave pattern, just like Huttris, is going to be annoying because you're trying to like avoid those while also fighting other enemies. But otherwise, in terms of the standard enemies, besides that, I don't know. I felt like it wasn't too bad. It was just mostly the maze aspect that made Africa really difficult.
Yeah, the only weird thing about the enemies is that one is vulnerable to Orcus, one is vulnerable to Huttris, and again, there's no real indication, just sort of to decide to try Huttris on one of them. So we get to King Amin, who uses giant throwing axe, and we fight him for the orange topaz, the devil of Zimbabwe. How did you fare against this Hokuto no Ken motherfucker?
Oh man, I mean, he's probably gonna wreck me with that giant axe like a dart or something, but he's actually just weak to ice ball like everything else. I think I tanked most of those hits to the axes anyway because I couldn't really dodge them, but
No.
I just pretty much, sent out ice ball as always and then fenced as much as I could and then repeated the process while trying to not eat axe too many times.
Sounds like that's going to be the theme of the podcast. It already has been. But
Perhaps.
yeah, I like his design, and I like that he has. There's a couple of repeated archetypes through these bosses. You'll notice that there's a couple of mage type enemies, even though their projectiles are in a different patterns and things like that, and there's a couple of fencers and that, so it's good to have this buff dude that throws axes. It stands out.
I mean, he's
Now, the
represent
next.
the entire continent of Africa, so.
So the next level is another maze, and it's Germany. Although, I think I found that the connections are more readily apparent this time. Like, although the castle kind of loops in places, it makes a bit more sense than Africa did.
Yeah, I found Germany still pretty labyrinthine, but compared to Africa, I think just the more constrained aspect of Germany made me feel less obnoxious to try to figure out the pattern, but I also used GameFAQs for this, so,
I think the biggest thing about the maze here is that there's a lot of pits in Germany, and that if you fall through, you have to repeat like large sections of the stage.
least no one's slinging mud at me in this stage, so I think the platforming was that bad, but
There are dudes that throw axes through the wall at you,
yeah, that's true.
though. Yeah, so I think in general, it's just a better maze, and I think Africa would have benefited by maybe being a bit more expansive, but have the same kind of labyrinth feel as this in terms of it making a little bit more sense in terms of how it progresses. The enemies are most guys. They take a few hits, but other than that, I think the ones that throw axes are probably the worst ones, right?
Yeah, and also there's bats because of course there are, but they're mostly enemies you've kind of seen before already.
The boss of Germany is Walter Schmidt, who you will see only once in this game, and he
Couldn't get out of his
throws.
castle.
Yeah, too good for the rest of the world. Walter Schmidt again. Walter Schmidt throws shurikens in like rising arcs. He throws them down, and then they. And we fight Walter for the purple amethyst, the fabled fairy of Granada. How did you find Walter Schmidt?
Actually, this I thought this was a pretty cool boss. He's just throwing shurikens, and I don't know. Seems very flamboyant at doing so, but as the running theme for this game, I just used Ice Ball and then stabbed him a lot of times.
Yeah, I think it's in terms of approach, Walter can be maybe the second most approach after Italy, Gino. So if you only have ice balls, yeah, I guess you have to contend with the shurikens. Which, yeah, I like this boss.
I do
I
too.
think, as you said, he's got a lot of character. There's a few, I mean, the bosses, they have character, except for the fencers don't have a shitload of character, but the projectile bosses and King Amin has a lot.
Well, King Amin's also kind of a projectile boss because he throws the axe, so.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So that brings us to the last level. Now, Arabia is the last level in the recommended sequence of events, except for the House of Ruth, which is only available after all the other levels are complete. This level, Arabia, it's very straightforward with tons and tons of enemies, including respawn doors, which haven't been talked about yet. How did you feel about Arabia?
It's pretty much like a beefed up India in terms of enemies. But then again, there's also skeletons, there's bats there. And there have been respawn doors before, but they haven't been placed in areas where they're just really obnoxious. But now it just seems everywhere you go, there's a respawn door. And once you take care of one enemy, just in a few seconds, another one will show up at you. And you just really want to keep your health up, which is not easy in this level.
No, this level is built to beat you down and drain your hit points. And of course, there is a full refill towards the end of the level, but you just have to get there, right?
Yeah.
And these respawn doors, they're often placed ahead of where you fight the enemy. So you'll fight an enemy, and then they'll immediately respawn. You have to fight them.
They're always by when you want to get up staircases.
Yeah, exactly. The most tricky, I guess, part of the level, and it's not tricky in terms of difficult, it's just understanding that you have to release Kutris on an upper floor, go down in order to hit the switch. So
Yeah.
you have to leave Kutris at the top of the screen. But other than that, I guess, although this is sort of a slog through masses of enemies, it's maybe a bit of a break from the two mazes we had. So we get to the boss. Now, this is sort of a. Sort of like the first boss. It's Gadi Rochelle. And he kind of fences with a scimitar, but he also throws knives when you're at a distance. And we fight Gadi for a white diamond, the Tear of the Nile. How do you feel about this particular boss?
For some reason, Ice Ball isn't as effective because he just takes forever to take down for some reason. But I mean, it's kind of mostly the same process. But I think I was really, really cutting it close on this one just because it's really difficult to dodge anything, and that sword just has a lot of range.
Yeah, it's definitely a difficult fight. Just a complete upgrade from the very first boss, and I guess that makes sense when you consider that, yeah, this is the sequence that they intended. Although, we'll see what happens in the next level. Arabia comes into play a little expected. Otherwise, we have some tea with Gadi, and we're finally able. I'm not sure where this level actually takes place. England or something, I guess. I
I
don't
made a
know.
joke. It's probably America.
Probably America. Eurasian countries, African countries, and then it's in America, for sure. But House of Ruth, this level is different than the rest because it's a boss rush. How did you feel about fighting these bosses when your sword is weak against every one of them?
I mean, you can still repeat the same ice ball strategy, and that is the way to go, but gosh, it just takes forever now. And there are some healing items. Well, there is only one healing item in the stage, but I would usually try to save up until I had like maybe half health and then use them. But yeah, at least for the first boss, you don't really need it, but yeah, it's just like, gosh, it just takes so long now.
It's interesting for this particular level. Start with a full meter for Futris, Aura, and then items. And as you said, every single room has a full heal in it that you can restore yourself.
Course, you have to find it,
And
like everything else in this game.
yeah, of course, but it's there. So if you want to take the time to look, it's there. It's good.
I mean, there's also a password system in this game, we should point out, so it's not like if you die here, it's game over completely, and you have to do this entire mess all over again.
Oh yeah, no, that would be terrible because you probably would. Okay. And also you begin with every sub weapon, so you have to have the ice ball right off the bat. Usually you have to get it from one of those little Jawa dudes, but it's fine. It's fine here. The sequence of bosses is Spain, Egypt, and then Arabia, then Italy, India, and Africa, and Germany.
I'm telling you, you
I'm
couldn't
not
get out
sure
of his
why.
castle.
I guess not. I don't know why there's no Germany if it's a space issue, because like every time you beat a boss you get healed completely, so it's not a huge deal.
Yeah.
Did you like that there's a boss rush, or would you rather have?
I think I would have preferred like a brand new dungeon because I don't know, boss rush in this scenario just doesn't seem as exciting to me. And I mean, it wasn't the entire point that we just had tea with them and we get the jewel.
Yeah.
So aren't we all like okay now? Like we did our negotiation, so why am I fighting them again?
That's sort of how I felt, and there's no real indication that Ruth brought them under her heel. And so when I decided this was a boss rush, again, you said, didn't I have tea with these people? It's like, didn't the skeleton give us tea and chiffon cake and shit? And so why are we
Is that
at
what
this?
Orin was talking about over tea? So like, hey, when I get all eight, go to the House of Ruth and come kick my ass.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess in terms of a boss rush, it's not very exciting. You have so much at your disposal and can heal completely between bosses. It just takes longer than the first time you fight. Sword
Yeah.
is weak against everything. Except who is the final boss? Ruth Grandier? Guilty
What a
Whip?
surprise. In our house in
Yeah.
the listed country or continent.
Exactly. And she has the most medalist fight of all the eight eyes, the blue diamond, the nail of nightmares. So, how do you feel about fighting Ruth Grandier?
Oh man, Ruth comes in, she's got this like whip and she's got this horse head thing on her. I don't know what that's going on here, but just like every other boss in this game, you can just throw ice ball and then fence away and then repeat the process.
And I think, unlike every other boss, your sword's going to be strong against. So she takes a bit. Doesn't take quite as long as the bosses you just fought.
Then there's still a heal in that stage too, so it's not actually as big of a deal.
Yeah, so she goes down just like every other boss.
You know,
I
I
think so.
respect her for her fashion and having a
Oh,
whip, I
yeah.
guess. 'Cause she's the real Castlevania here.
Sort of Elvira across the dragon tamer from. Yeah, she's pretty cool. And it was interesting that the last duke was a lady, and none of the other bosses were. But yeah, it's pretty cool. I wish they explained a little bit more lore throughout the game, because you get clue scrolls, but they're out of a bit lore. We'll talk about them in a minute. Before I forget, I guess the only other difference I want to talk about with these bosses is that the Italy boss, Gino, his panther's on the top floor, so you can just ignore it completely. And that kind of simplifies the fight on the rematch, to be honest. But once all seven bosses are defeated,
And you've had tea with Ruth, of course.
and you've had tea with Ruth, of course, we come to the final puzzle of the game. The puzzle is to set the eight eyes in sequence and win the game. We don't need to talk about the actual solution, but I want to talk a bit about the nature of how do you feel about the final puzzle?
I guess it gives a reason to why those scrolls are very vague about, like, purple is not next to yellow or something. Like, what does that even mean? Does that mean, like, a stage? Of course, I noted it down because it's probably important. And yeah, here we go. That's what it's all about.
Can you imagine getting here and not have any
Oh
goals?
my god, what would happen? Do you just get game over immediately? That would just be awful.
No, basically you get a chance to continue immediately if you fail, and you have a password just before, so there's no big deal.
No, okay, well then.
So it's not so bad. The other thing is, I find that some of the colors look the same on the NES Palace. So that could be tricky as well for some people, depending on like what range of color you can see
Yeah.
or what monitor you're using, especially back then. Not every TV was going to have, the contrast and all that set to the right contrast. I think it's a cool puzzle.
Definitely is a cool puzzle, yeah.
I don't necessarily think the clue scrolls are implemented very well,
No, not at
but
all.
that's something we're going to cover in the wrap up. So we're getting into the wrap up for Eight Eyes. As we alluded to at the end of the last segment about these clue scrolls, there's actually a lot of hidden items in Eight Eyes. There's jars that'll double your attack power for a brief amount of time. There are jars that'll make you invulnerable or increase the health parameters or heal you, or these clue scrolls that give you a hint for that final puzzle. And the clue scrolls are sort of necessary to beat the game without countless trial and error attempts, of course. And they require you to search pretty well every block of the screen, although usually when you see where they're hidden, it's in a way that kind of makes sense. Now, how do you feel about the hidden items in Eight Eyes?
I feel like, not to compare it to Castlevania again, but I think they're trying to maybe allude to sort of like meat hidden in the wall. But considering how important these things are, especially they are cruel though. The clue scrolls. I don't know. I feel like there should have been a little bit more indication, or I don't know, maybe if you look really carefully, one of the bricks looks slightly different, like something with the outline, or just some way of giving you a hint about the clue scrolls at least. But I mean, everything's kind of important. Like the blue jars you can find, which give you like more HP for that stage, are important too. So, I mean, again, it's understandable that there are hidden items. That's like sort of a NES thing to do. But I wish there was a little more indication about them, and at least put them in places where it wouldn't be obnoxious to get them. Because especially when you need to like fight all the enemies, and then try to take care of flying enemies, which I'm gonna repeat that I really hate, is just kind of obnoxious. And you're not gonna be an expert at Kuturis right away, but since Kuturis is usually, again, most of them, especially ones like in the middle of a set of blocks that you wouldn't be able to reach normally, that's pretty much where you have to figure out where most things are hidden, and then it's just a lot. It's maybe too much, I think.
Well, that's the thing. Without the manual, you might not know that Kuturis can even break blocks. I think if you play this game and see it's got visually a Castlevania style, then you will try to hit blocks that Oren can hit that are, at the end of a hallway or something. Usually, the blocks that you check for sub-weapon multipliers or pot roasts in Castlevania, right? But in Eight Eyes, you will get some things in the manner, but sometimes there's these overhangs ceiling that Kutris can hit for items, and then Kutris can collect them by flying into them. I think at some point you will find, just through happenstance, that Kutris will hit a block, and you will see that block has an item. Okay. Well, from now on, I'm going to have to check all of these blocks to see if the Falcon can find an item. And once you find the clue scroll, well, then you're going to be like, these seem like they're... I have to go back and do these other... I like arcane things in games, but I like there to be some indication that it's something that you can manipulate. And I think that's maybe where Eight Eyes kind of fails in that respect, is that it's not made clear enough that these very important items are hidden in tiles in the ceiling, right? And generally, the clue scrolls, there's a couple I think Orin can reach, but most of them you have to use Kutris to get.
Yeah.
And unless you know that they exist, and you know that you can get items in the ceiling, then you're just going to be trying to progress through the level. You're not really going to be trying to look in the ceiling for things, because that takes a long, long time. If you're not using a map or a guide or whatever the hell you're going to use for this game, feel free for Eight Eyes, I guess, just to know the right story, just know the right boss progression if you want to do them quickly, I guess. Whatever fill your boots in that respect. But playing this back when I first played it, and I don't know how many resources were available, there's a lot of things about this game that aren't super conducive to playing it and learning it, but once you know they're there, it's fine that it's there. I think this could be communicated a bit better that they are there.
I mean, it also would have helped too if Africa and, to a lesser extent, Germany were also less trial and error, but I could also just be really impatient. But I feel like Africa, as we talked previously, just seems really repetitive without loop, like, or indication that you're making the correct passageway through the stage.
I don't mind that there's mazes, but I like the Germany format a bit better than Africa. In general, and I say this about kind of situations like this, I would rather have larger stages that are more structured like Germany, or more structured, or even have branches that go off the clue scroll at the end of. I'd rather have more content than padded out by flying a falcon into, you know, the gyprock in the ceiling 1,000 times, but you know, I think the clue scrolls are maybe it's sort of a moot complaint these days when you can just look up the solution. But I mean, it's good. It's fun to figure that kind of stuff. I mentioned that there is that's basically been the whole progression of the podcast, is that there is a level progression that's sort of suggested in this game. How do you feel about gaining and losing sword power over bosses? And how does this make a game that's presented as a non-linear progression have a definite intended sequence of progression? How do you feel about this?
Yeah, I'm not really too much of a fan of it, especially when you go to a new stage after clearing the first one. You're like, okay, cool, I have a new powerful sword. Then even if you pick a different stage that wasn't intended, it doesn't seem like you made the right choice, because your sword just seems to be the same length and seems to be doing the same damage to similar enemies anyway. So I wish there was sort of like maybe a better indication about what the linearity of the game wanted you to do. And it's not really easy just to go all the way to the end of the stage and fight a boss and realize, oh, this sword doesn't work for that boss. It's just more trial and error again that I think is too exhaustive for this.
Yeah, and although the levels are short, getting to the end of them the first time, or even getting to the end and find the right sword for the job, that could be tedious. And I'm pretty sure it's possible to beat these... Well, it is possible to beat these enemies without the sword upgrade. But if you beat an enemy without the sword upgrade, then you don't know who their sword upgrade is good against. Maybe if you beat, like, King Amin, and he's like, oh, I fucking hate Gino, or something like that. You know, and say, okay, well, King Amin's sword was good against Gino, then. You know, maybe a little bit like that. It's fine that they say it's a country near France that has the first boss you can go through in the manual.
Or but that's only in the manual, not in-game.
Yeah,
and I think it would be far more useful in-game, by the way.
Exactly, but if Taxan want to present this, or you know, what have you, they want to present this in their manual, they could have little blurbs in each of these. Like, they got all this strange lore in the terms of the boss enemies. They could say, oh, Walter Schmidt had a fight with Nasir or something, and then you know that either way, like, Walter is good against Nasir, or Nasir is good against or something.
Yeah.
There's ways that they could do it, even if they just wanted to use the manual. And there's ways that they could do it in-game. It's like, in Mega Man, you could choose a boss, like a robot master, and beat it with the arm cannon. Or you can choose a robot master and beat it much more quickly. Weakness, but at the very least, like every level that you can select in Mega Man from the get-go, it affords you a starting which level you select, because if you want to do a progression of enemy weaknesses, you can pick any robot master and just make your way around, or mix up the order and still make do just as well as the first one that you fought. Well, maybe, obviously some are more difficult than others. I don't think that's really the case, because although you can wear down an enemy with a weaker sword, it definitely helps to have the upgrade, because you're not gifted with so much health power as you are in the House of Ruin for most of these levels. And yeah, I guess it's kind of a kick in the privates when you get to the end of a level and yeah, you're just not that effective and you die. Your sword's not that effective. And then you're like, okay, instead of just getting back and all over again, you're constantly jumping around the world on these different maps. Anyhow, I think it just... I don't mind that this is a factor. I just think it could be handled more elegantly.
Yeah, and when you bring up Mega Man, when you do clear a stage, at least you do get some sort of feedback that you cleared the stage, instead of just having the stage being blocked off in general. You can use that new metal blade in whatever stage you want to go at now, so you know how useful that is in Mega Man 2. But yeah, there's really no actual sword feedback when it says you have a more powerful sword against any normal enemies, so you wouldn't even feel like you did anything. It just doesn't feel like you really cleared that stage anyway, and you wouldn't know until the boss, of course, and then that's when you ultimately find out what happened, if you chose correctly or not.
It makes me almost wonder why they have a sort of stage select on the, you know, stage select available. Maybe it's so you can go back and get clues. Well, you can't go back and get...
You can't go back, that's the thing, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why it just doesn't have a linear progression then. I guess.
Or at least let you go back on stages.
Yeah. I guess it was just to pad the game out, but... If they were going to do this with the weapons, I wonder why they did that. Rather than just, like, you know, give you a sub-weapon every as a reward and carry through the game with you or something.
And anyway, you only use really one.
Yeah, but they give you the ice ball. So you actually have to play the game this time. Eight Eyes is often considered a Castlevania. How valid are these arguments? And how well does Eight Eyes set itself apart?
I definitely think it got inspiration from Castlevania, but I really wouldn't say it's a clone. It just feels too different, especially because, you know, the whole searching for these clues in the blocks and then the entire use of Kudrys. I think that sets itself apart, and it doesn't really feel as platformy as a Castlevania game. And as we were just mentioning about the really weird order of stages, that sets it apart from the usual linearity of just a Castlevania 1, or even like Castlevania 3, but that's still sort of a direct path you're on. It's not really jumping around different stages in the game. So, yeah, it definitely took inspiration from Castlevania in terms of like the graphics, the stairs, and hitting the wall, but I would not say it's a Castlevania clone.
Yeah, I would tend to agree that the clone status is overtouted. There are a lot of elements, but it definitely does its own thing, and whether or not it does this well is what we're getting into pretty soon. But yeah, I think it's probably unfair to discount Eight Eyes just because it looks like Castlevania, because it is its own thing. And it did try to do a lot of cool stuff. Again, whether or not that was successful, we'll get into pretty soon. But yeah, I think it definitely sets itself apart well from other games. You just have to take the time to play it. Now, it also has a reputation of being a bad Castlevania clone. Now, we talked about its status as a clone, but Eight Eyes doesn't necessarily have the best reputation. How do you feel about the quality of this game?
A little mixed about Eight Eyes. I think it has a lot of charm and some cool ideas, but I think it gets awfully repetitive, maybe a little too quickly. Maybe I'm just having low patience nowadays, but I feel like a lot of enemies are kind of similar to other stages. Like, skulls move the same exact way as bats do, and bats move the same way as flies do, and skeletons essentially move the same way as humans. So it's just kind of like palette swaps of everything. And I mean, the music is also somewhat charming. It's also a little repetitive after a while, but I don't know. It seems like it had a lot of cool ideas, and I wish they pushed them further because I think the idea of being this fencer and all its flaws about boss order, that who knows what it was. I think it, with some refinement, I'd probably be a lot more receptive to it. But right now, I'm just like, I don't know if I really want to play it again. And there are second and third loops to this game for some reason.
Yeah, with faster enemies, yeah.
Yeah, so good
I
ideas,
guess.
but I think the execution could have been a lot better.
I guess I'm in a similar boat. I'm a bit. I guess I'm a bit soft on Eight Eyes' concept, but it does definitely need to be a bit more polished. I think that this is a game that would have benefited from coming out on a later generation console, like the SNES or Genesis, that would have a couple more buttons and a couple more opportunity to implement cooler things in a way that the better hardware or more current at the time hardware could provide. Like even using the Super Nintendo controller, many different things could Auron and Kudrys do with that many more buttons. You have a back step, you could have a dedicated Kudrys button, you could have a dedicated sub-weapon button with more memory and so on and so forth. You could have, collect distinct swords just like Crystallis and have them effective against certain enemies and things. There's more that could be done in this game. I think there is a lot of untapped potential. I don't think Eight Eyes is a bad game. I just think that it's a maybe a confused game at times in terms of how it wants to present itself. And I'm saying this as someone who again loves arcane games like Legacy of the Wizard, which has some pretty arcane shit in it too that what people would consider unfair, but I think you kind of know what you're in for going to Legacy of the Wizard, but with Eight Eyes presents itself as a an action game, action platformer. Kind of has some unexpected elements, but I don't think it's bad. I just think it could be implemented better. So in general, I think that Eight Eyes is an interesting chapter in the NES library. in games of this nature that, you know, it's sort of a game that people that collect or enthusiasts for the NES library find, and they either love it or they hate it. I'm kind of in the middle, actually. I think it's a game, like you said, with good ideas that maybe need meant to. I'm glad to finally play through it and put it to rest. This has been the podcast for August 2019, covering Eight Eyes on the NES. Well, thank you for listening. If you want to reach me, it's twitter.com/Mattazoic, MATTOZOIC, like the Mesozoic era except the dinosaur. Website's the same, mattazoic.com. Chris, where can we reach you?
You can reach me at twitter.com/Karasu, CAWRASU.
And if you want to reach Arrow?
If you want to reach Arrow, who's probably very upset from your intro, you can reach her at twitter.com/agrocast, AGROCAST.
Well, she didn't have to go to space or anything like that.
Whatever.
This month, we a little bit more content. What are we doing for September?
For September, we are going to play the first sequel to Chrono Trigger, Radical Dreamers, the visual novel, and a strange beta Stellaview game.
Yeah, so I haven't played this. I maybe read the synopsis 15 years ago, so I'm interested in seeing what goes down and, you know, how it compares to Chrono Trigger and Chrono Cross. So we'll find out in a month, I guess.
Till then, cheers.
Cheers.
When Lipton blows the whistle, you gotta have a cup of tea. Listen to the Lipton whistle. Brisk, brisk, brisk. Lipton tea.
Lipton flow through tea bags. Like two bags of flavor in one.